Good evening, and welcome to episode 9 of the Jamie Delaney Plant-Based Wellness Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Delaney. I'm a plant-based cardiologist and endurance athlete living in Southwest Florida. Today, I'll have Matt Fraser, who is known for his book, No Meat Athlete, Run on Plants and Discover Your Fittest, Fastest, Happier Self. He has transformed himself through running first and then adopting a plant-based lifestyle. He has been a prolific writer and blogger, and his career has completely changed direction since taking up running and a plant-based diet. I think you'll enjoy his story. He also has a great website on the No Meat Athlete, where he has roadmaps for the marathon, half marathon, triathlon. He also has a site for running your Boston qualifier. A lot of his story has to do with how he endeavored to run a Boston qualifier. Now he lays out a plan for others to try. I actually am trying to follow it for my January marathon somewhat. I still want to keep the triathlon training go, so I'm kind of doing the running parts and trying to hold on to biking and swimming in there. I think it's kind of fun to... I'm self-coached at this point, and part of my enjoyment with endurance athletics is trying to find out what works best for me and going back to the drawing board and evolving as an athlete, both with training and nutrition. So I do a lot of things wrong, but I have a good time experimenting on myself, and I'm kind of the only one that gets hurt, so I guess that's okay. Before we get started with the interview, I just want to talk a little bit. Thanksgiving is coming up, and as a cardiologist, I refer to the beginning of the eating season with Thanksgiving and the parties along with Christmas and New Year's. It's often a difficult time for my patients. There's certainly a lot of weight gain, but the biggest problem in the cardiology practice is congestive heart failure. People don't realize how much salt is in processed foods, especially if you go out or go to parties. Ham typically has, you know, and all the different fun foods that are at a lot of these parties tend to carry a lot of salt, so people get into trouble very quickly. So I try to have people, you know, weigh themselves and be very conscious about what they eat. You know, even to the point of eating before you go to some of these events so that you won't be starved and get into a bunch of bad things trying to get full really quick. Like we talked about before, I'd like to think of these a lot of these get-togethers and holiday parties not so much as get together just to eat, but to get together with and enjoy people's companies over the holidays. So I think it'd be better if we could make it a little bit more about the season and a little bit less about eating, but it doesn't seem to be going that way in our society. Looking on the first holiday that comes around, Thanksgiving, at my house, my daughter's coming home from college, so we'll have our vegan Thanksgiving. We're going to do a field roast that has... walnuts and cranberries this year, as well as one with mushrooms. We also do lima beans, sweet potatoes, cranberry salad. My mom makes her favorite stuffing balls, which are made with vegetable broth. And, of course, outside the turkey, since there's not a turkey, we have mushroom gravy and mashed potatoes and pumpkin pie. And I'll probably do an apple cake that I made this weekend as well that has apples, and it's a little bit like a fruitcake for those people that aren't that crazy about pumpkin pie. So I hope you enjoy the upcoming interview with Matt, and we'll talk a little afterwards. Welcome, Matt Fraser. Matt is the author of No Meat Athlete, Run on Plants and Discover Your Fittest and Fastest Self. I'm a owner of the book. I also am part of your Run Your BQ. Sorry to say I haven't quite accomplished that yet, but follow along with your blog and have enjoyed it. So welcome.
Great, thank you. Yeah, I'm excited to be on here.
So tell me a little bit, were you an athlete growing up?
I was an athlete, just like any kid was an athlete. I played baseball, soccer, then golf in high school. So I guess I became less athletic actually as I got older because I shifted towards golf, which didn't require quite the intensity of soccer.
Yes.
But nothing serious. Nothing beyond that.
Uh-huh. And so tell me a little bit about your story. I read your book. Basically, you and your buddies decided that you were going to run a two-hour marathon. And how'd all that go?
Sure. Actually, so we decided first, I mean, my friends and I in college got into weightlifting, and it was really the first time that I had seriously done anything related to fitness. And we were kind of competitive, you know, like we weren't macho, but we thought we were. One day, one of my roommates came home and said, "Hey, I have an idea. Let's go do a half marathon because it would help us lose some fat, and it just seems like a great challenge." And none of us were runners at all, but by the end of that night, we had decided that we weren't just going to run a half marathon; we were going to run a full marathon because why do something halfway? We said, and we actually went online to sign up for the Boston Marathon because we didn't know anything about running. So we found out very quickly that you can't just sign up for the Boston Marathon. You have to actually qualify. And at our age back then, actually, it took a 3-hour and 10-minute marathon. So that was our goal, was to break 3 hours and 10 minutes. Long story short, we missed that by a ton of time. We ran 4 hours and 53 minutes. So we missed it by over 100 minutes, but did end up finishing the marathon. And after that, I just kind of got hooked on the Boston goal. I don't know what it was, but just like jumping in from being non-runner to marathon runner, I had this little taste of what that felt like what it felt like to run 26.2 miles and say that I did that. And then I just decided that I was going to qualify for Boston, take those 104 minutes off my marathon time, and just figure out a way to do it, no matter how long it took to get there. And it ended up taking 7 years, the last year of which, or so, really the last 6 months of which, is when I switched my diet to from just a full omnivorous diet to a vegetarian diet, because I didn't know anything about vegetarian or vegan or anything at the time. I just didn't feel right about eating meat, so I decided to make the switch. I thought it was going to really just ruin my marathon progress. I thought it wasn't going to work because not enough protein, not enough calories, all the kind of myths that you hear. But I decided to do it anyway because my progress towards Boston had kind of slowed, and I thought, well, what do I have to lose at this point? And I did it, and 6 months faster, 6 months later, I took 10 minutes off my marathon from where I was, got from 320 down to 309, and got into Boston. So that's where my vegetarian story began, and then I went vegan and got into ultra running after that.
Was the switch to vegan just to, again, try to get healthier, or was that more of, okay, well, I'm not eating animal products, so I'll take it one step further, some ethical parts of it, or how did that go?
Yeah, it was really driven by ethics. And a lot of people are surprised to hear that because what I do on my site and what I write about, is almost never about ethics. I just don't really like writing about that or trying to, make judgments about what's right and wrong for other people. I just kind of do what is right for me and what I feel right about doing. So it was really ethical. When I first went vegetarian, at the same time, I, for some reason, just cut out dairy. I just kind of mostly stopped drinking milk, found it easy to replace it with almond milk. And I probably went vegetarian halfway vegan right away. But then it took about 2 years for me to fully just kind of draw the line and say, okay, I'm not going to eat any more cheese, even once every 2 weeks on pizza or whatever I was doing at the time. So it was just ethical. Like, after I went vegetarian and started the blog, I started to read different books and talk to different people and just suddenly be exposed to this whole world of activism and plant-based diets and, I mean, all kinds of amazing people that I met because I started the blog. So, I got educated. I just started reading books, watching the documentaries, and realized within a year that I did not want to be eating animal products. I wanted to be vegan. But it took me about a year from there to just gradually eliminate the rest of the animal products from my diet. So it took a while. But once I drew the line and said, this is it, then it wasn't at all a problem. And I did notice that, it's hard for me to say because it was so gradual that, like, I noticed some huge health benefit when I went from vegetarian to vegan. I really didn't. But when I look back now, and, like, I look back at what I can do as a runner. So last summer I ran 100 miles, my first 100-mile ultramarathon. And to prepare for that, I had the training plan that I was following had me running a 50-mile run, like, I don't know, 8 weeks before that, and a 50K run, maybe 6 weeks before it. So, like, when I look back at how I was as a marathoner before I went vegetarian, especially, if I ran two marathons in 3 months, that got me injured. So that I could, the fact that I could now do this much, I mean, it says how far I've come as a runner, but I really do think that a lot of that and the kind of injury, you know, just not being as susceptible to injury, I think that probably has something to do with diet. I don't want to say it's entirely because of diet, but I think there's a place to part for sure.
Yeah, I don't think enough credit is given to nutrition. You know, it kind of bugs me. I started out as a meat-eating marathoner and, you know, gradually switched over to being plant-based. And when I gave up dairy, of course, that was huge in the end of GI problems. But, of course, it bothers me now, I guess, as a so-called reformed nutrition-based runner, you know, with how people eat. You know, it's kind of a license to eat all the junk food you want. And I think that it's somewhat of a disservice, you know, especially down the road for people. And I really like, you know, your, I guess it's your ebook, you know, the 5K plus nutrition. I think that's a huge service because you're getting people into running as well as the nutrition.
Yeah, I really think you're right about that. That nutrition is really overlooked. I mean, pros and, you know, people who are really serious about this, I think they're starting to really come around. I think the plant-based movement has grown a lot, and not just plant-based. Like, I mean, you can recover well as a runner without a plant-based diet. I'm not saying that's the only way to do it. But like you said, a lot of runners treat running as their license to eat whatever they want. But they, you know, they're still serious about running and they still want to recover as fast as they can. But I think people just don't understand that. And I don't know if there's a lot of science out there or if there's a big lack of science out there. But certainly just kind of anecdotally in my own case and just seeing what I see on the internet and books and things like that, it really seems like it's not just get the right amount of carbohydrate, fat, and protein in the right ratio. Like that, people get that much, I think. But it's making sure that you have all the micronutrients and all the micronutrients that we don't even know about. I mean, just when you start eating tons and tons of fresh fruits and vegetables, I'm not saying eliminate all meat and all dairy, that you have to do that, but I think people are by and large neglecting those fresh fruits and vegetables, and I think there's so much there that can aid in recovery. But we don't really think of those as recovery foods. You don't think of a big salad as helping you with recovery because it doesn't have a lot of calories in it. So I think people are really missing that, and I hope they're coming around. I'm not sure that they are, though.
Yeah, I did see an article, and I think it was in either Runner's World or Runner's Time. There was a guy, I believe, in New Mexico who's an exercise physiologist, and he actually, you know, went around with a van and did muscle samples, and they did some testing on people and, you know, really kind of found out that you could refuel with McDonald's and kind of recover okay. But I think the long-term, as far as your long-term health, I'm not so sure that, you know, I mean, you know, just like your car, you can drive a car and never get the oil changed and do all kinds of bad things for a long time, and then when it breaks, it really breaks, you know.
right.
Now, is your
the long term health has certainly been a big benefit. That when I went vegetarian, like that was one of the things that kind of caused me to say, okay, I'm going to actually do this. Well, because although I still kind of questioned how it would do in the short term, as for me as a runner, I started to believe that it would kind of set me up better long term, and I truly do believe that now, especially about a completely plant-based vegan diet.
Do you have any family history for heart disease or diabetes? Or
yes, we have tons of heart disease in the males in my family. So that wasn't on my mind when I made the switch, but I sure am happy now that I as I learn all these things about a vegan diet being, you know, perhaps the best diet for preventing heart disease, that certainly helped me out, makes me feel better.
And is your, I know you have a son, and I've heard, you know, I don't stalk you, but I do listen to your podcast regularly. But, you know, is your family plan? I know you guys did the 80-10-10. I want to hear about that retreat. But do you, your family, does your wife go plant-based with you right away, or how did that go?
Yep, she sure did. She went vegetarian when I wanted to, and then when I said, let's try being vegan, she was on board for that, too. So, yeah, she and I are both pretty vegan, and that has certainly made it way, way easier. I have, you know, complete respect for anyone who makes this happen when their spouse is not on board. I think that's a very, you know, much more difficult thing to do. So So I'm grateful that my wife has been on board. And our son, he's completely vegetarian, totally vegan in the house, because we don't buy anything that's not vegan. But if he's out at, you know, at a friend's birthday party or something, and there are cupcakes there that aren't vegan, we don't tell him he can't have it. We a lot of times try to like provide an alternative and say, here, we have this for you if you want it, or you can have these, but you know that they're not vegan. So we don't want to try to force anything. Just we want to kind of guide and explain things, but we're not trying to force him to do it. But you know, it's great to just talk to him about why we eat this way, and we talk about animals, and he helps out with gardening, and he helps with cooking, and I feel like he has such an incredible awareness about food and where it comes from, and you know, I'm just happy. Like if he grows up with that in mind, and he makes a different choice, you know, that's fine with me. If I feel like he understands why he's choosing or just why he's eating, rather than the default eat McDonald's because that's what everyone else does, you know, so that's kind of our approach to that.
Yeah, at least he's developed taste buds for nutritious food, so you know he has.
Yeah, and that's a huge thing, I think. Yeah, you know, I think we don't give kids a chance to eat healthy a lot of times. We just give them what we assume is kids' food, and that's so often nowadays junk food. And I think from you know almost from birth they're thinking that food has to taste like this, you know, this really intense flavored food like you know salt and sugar and everything else. And they don't really get the chances that when they eat healthy foods after that, they don't really want them. But, yeah, we've tried to avoid that. And we've done a pretty good job with it.
Yeah, I heard Dr. Furman's daughter just wrote a book, and I heard her talking about when she was growing up, I think, you know, during her rebellious years, 13 or whatever, she was, you know, hiding under the bed with cookies because her dad wouldn't let any. You know,
I love him. I didn't know if he'd written the book. What's it called, you know?
No, I don't have it offhand. She just was on Main Street Vegan with the mm-hmm. Talking about the book, and I'm blocking on it right now. It was it's somewhat mainly written towards younger people. You know, she's more of an ethical vegan at this point in her life, and I think it's a very lighthearted, good recipes, but you know, really geared towards younger people. So I think it's a fantastic. You know, audience that she's trying to reach as well.
Yeah, definitely. I would check that out.
So tell me, how did it come? So you you run and you spend all this time and you finally, you know, qualify for the Boston. And is that what led you to write your book? Are you a writer by trade or how did that all come about?
I have become a writer by trade completely unintentionally, really. I studied finance in undergrad and then applied math in graduate school. So no writing really, but I always was okay at writing and I always got good grades in it and teachers always said, yes, you write well. So, I mean, I guess I've kind of always been able to do it. I just started writing because when I wanted to share this whole thing, when I went vegetarian and was still kind of set on qualifying for Boston, I just thought it was an interesting experiment and I thought it would kind of surprise a lot of people and maybe help out a lot of people who were in the same boat, but because when I started, this was back in 2009, the website, not the book yet, there really wasn't very much out there about plant-based nutrition and sports. There was Brendan Brazier's book, Thrive, had come out not that long ago, but online there was very, very little, and what little there was online wasn't very friendly for the reader. It wasn't very welcoming. Some of it was kind of preachy, vegan. Some of it was of questionable, you know, worth as you know, just you couldn't tell where the information was coming from. So that was why I started. I just said this would be a fun thing to document the progress and see what happened. So I just started writing, and within those 6 months between when I went vegetarian and when I qualified for Boston, a lot of people kind of grabbed onto the story and what I was doing and were cheering me on, which was great. And then from there, you know, it just became like a business, and it was really an easy transition. So it's kind of it became what I did was writing, and then the book came along. I guess probably 3 years after that or so.
Yeah, I think the book is certainly very informative. You know, one of your energy bar recipes, I like how you kind of broke it down, you know, as far as the different parts and your different choices. So it kind of made it easy as opposed to, okay, here's the energy bar. You can, you know, mix and match a lot of things. And so there's a lot of good ideas there.
Yeah, the reason I like those formulas, and we did the same thing for the smoothie and the veggie burger, is because, like, it just, I don't know, with kids and stuff, like, I feel like it's not very often that I have all the ingredients on hand for a recipe. I always have to go out and get something or plan ahead and plan several recipes, go to the store, buy them, which is fine. But it's nice to be able to whip up a veggie burger or an energy bar or a smoothie, knowing that, like, I can probably find something in my pantry that fits the criteria there and throw together some sort of veggie burger. And it may not be the best tasting one, as good as one that I would plan out. But yeah, I like that. I like it. That formula idea is something that I use a lot.
So how did you fuel for your 100 marathon or 100 mile race?
So with that, first of all, the great thing about running 100 and why I would recommend it to anyone who's considering it is that it forced me, partly out of fear, to really learn about nutrition and what, not so much learn about nutrition and what was optimal for runners, but experiment and figure out what worked for my body, like what could stay in my stomach, how much water did I need, how much salt should I be getting with it. I had to finally like figure out the numbers there and try different things. So that was one of the great benefits of doing that. And what I decided on as my strategy, I don't remember exactly what it was now, but I started out for as long as I could. I said I was going to rely on primarily dates, some boiled potatoes. I drank heat sports drink, and now and then some pita, like not whole wheat, just plain old white, because I feel like that's easier to digest when you're running. Just white pitas with almond butter or hummus or refried beans on them, and some extra salt sprinkled on them. So I kind of stuck to that, and I had a specific plan, you know, had my crew give me those in different orders, things like that. Stuck with that for as long as I could, but I knew that at some point it would turn into no longer what's the optimal food, but what actually sounds okay. Like, what can I actually stomach at this point? And that was probably about 40 miles in when it turned into, like, the, I don't know, every man for himself sort of idea. But I just eat whatever you possibly can eat that seems good, eat it. So at that point, I don't know, I tried to keep it as healthy as I could. It wasn't until the last, like, 20 or 30 miles that I started letting myself just eat whatever I felt like. Like, a cup of coffee, a box of Numinos, a Silka burger. I mean, just all kinds of stuff that I don't even usually eat at home, that I would never eat, but did that because it sounded good and I was prepared for that. So I have a big list on my site. If you do Google No Meat Athlete, you know, 100 mile recap or something, you'll see the big list. But yeah, it started out good with some good healthy stuff, and then it turned into just like a total junk. But that's all right. I got it done.
Yeah, it's what you can actually look at. So when you do the dates, you know, like dates versus a gel, what, you know, is it a couple dates to the equivalent of a gel, you think, or how does that go?
I think it is that one date has about 15 grams of sugar in it. Mm-hmm. And those 15 grams of sugar are primarily glucose, so they do get into the bloodstream very quickly. So, you know, between one and two dates is equivalent to a single gel. The big difference there is that the dates have fiber in them and energy gels do not, because they're specifically designed not to have that and to be as easy to take in as possible. So the fiber will accumulate. So it's hard to fuel an entire 100 miles on just dates, because the fiber will accumulate and then you'll have all kinds of, you'll be stopping going to the bathroom too much. So I think they're probably a better food for marathons than 100s, because there's not as much time for that fiber to accumulate. But they're kind of what I have always used for my typical energy gel replacement, because they're about the same size. I mean, 1 to 2 dates is about the size of an energy gel, and it tastes so much better, and it just feels good. I'd rather eat that than energy gel. But I'm kind of rethinking it. Like, for race day is rare enough that I'm thinking it would be valuable in the future for me to just get used to energy gels, to get used to stomaching them and being okay with that, so that on race day, which will be the exception, I actually can fuel a race with, you know, 20 energy gels or something, which I don't think would be a good thing to be doing all the time, day in, day out with your training. But if that's the very best thing you can do for a race, then, you know, I don't think it's a bad thing to do if you're trying to perform as well as you can on one given day.
Yeah, I think maybe it is a good idea to kind of save them for race day. It seems like if you train with them, and then I just did an Ironman, and by the time I got to the run, you know, I pulled out a gel and I put it back because I couldn't really look at it anymore, you know.
Right. Yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, the difficulty for that, like, if you're going to save them there, you need to also know that that come race day, you'll be able to handle them. Because it's hard to know, like, what happens when you get to gel number 10? Like, are you going to be just so sick and tired of these, and then your nutrition strategy is out the window? You don't want that to happen, but at the same time, you don't want to be doing all your training with gels either. So I guess it's a little bit of a balance there.
Yeah, I did try. We tried the boiled potatoes, or we actually roasted them on a 88-mile bike ride this past weekend, and they tasted marvelous. That was just really good. Get away from the sweet a little bit. I really like that.
Yeah, they're one of those foods for me that when nothing else sounds good, a potato sometimes sounds palatable because it just doesn't have that much flavor to it. If it's been boiled or cooked enough, it's very, very soft and easy to eat. And a lot of times when you're so sick of sugar, that's also when you're craving salt, and they're either dipping salt for a little bit of that too. So they're good.
When you were training for your Boston qualifier, and you know, over those 7 years or 9 years of experimentation, did you find that your ability, your training helped you decrease your carbohydrate requirements? Was that one of the things that helped you the most as far as your evolution to speed, or was it just the duration on your feet, or just the number of miles logged? Or, you know, what do you think got you over the hump?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think all of those things played a role for sure, and nutrition did too. I think all those things were a part of it, and it would be foolish to say that any one of those things is what, you know, got me 100 minutes faster. I think I did not. A few times I tried out to actually deliberately try to train my body to burn more fat, where you do, you know, carbohydrate depleted long runs and things like that. I did that once, twice, and did not have a good experience with it. Like, they were miserable runs when I just didn't allow myself to have sugar or only very small amount. So I didn't ever do much with trying to train my body, but I noticed that when I looked at myself 7 years after I had started running compared to, you know, in year one or two or three or even four, I could go for a run and eat way less than that run than ever before, and I could even take in less water than I used to. Like, I could get to the point where I could run a half marathon, not a racing one, but an easy half marathon without any food, without any water. And by the end, I'd be starting to tell that I needed it. But, you know, that would have been impossible for me to do when I had been running for, say, 2 years instead of six or seven. So I think that the time on your feet, something else you mentioned, just the act of getting out there and running, not necessarily doing hard workouts, not trying to deplete your carbohydrates or anything like that, just the act of getting out there and putting one foot in front of the other, for lack of a non-cliché term, but, like, literally just taking those steps. I think your brain gets better at running. You become more efficient as a runner. Your brain gets better at recruiting muscle fibers, and it's just easier to do. I mean, and the example that I would tell people, at least this is true in my experience, is because I had some periods where I would run a marathon and then, you know, have a little tweak injury thing that had been getting worse during the training, so I would take some time off. And a couple times I would go 3 or 6 months without doing any training at all. But I always found that when I returned from that, it didn't really take very long to get back into, say, half marathon shape. And so, like, if you were to take someone off the street and say, okay, go run a half marathon right now, they would say that's crazy. Like, it's just not possible, someone who's never run. But if you take someone who has run, who's run a marathon or two, and has then let themselves get out of shape, if you ask that person to go run a half marathon, chances are they could get it done. Or within just a few weeks, they could get themselves back into the condition where they could get it done, even if it's not pretty. And I think that's evidence that, you know, it's not so much about your fitness. Certainly your fitness level plays a big part, but I really do think that just all those steps out there, the thousands upon thousands and you know, perhaps hundreds of thousands or millions of steps, that each time you do that, your brain gets a little bit better at running. So if you can just stay out there and be consistent and, you know, avoid those 3 or 6 month layoffs and just get the runs in, I think that's the biggest thing. I think that is what made me just get faster, because I just running just became easier because I learned how to do it, and that was it.
That's very, very good advice. I listened to your podcast when you went to the 80-10-10 retreat at Veg Fest, and how did all that come about? I've read that book too, and it's like, man, that sounds like a really good idea. I've actually never took that plunge yet. Very much toyed with it, but never have gone the full day.
Yeah, so the The event was the Woodstock Fruit Festival in New York. It's put on by Michael Arnstein, who is an incredible ultra marathoner. I think he has I don't know if he still does, but this was earlier this year, had the seventh fastest American 100-mile time. It was under 13 hours. So an incredible runner, and he eats almost nothing but raw fruits and vegetables. No nuts and seeds, very, very low fat. And for anyone listening who doesn't know what 80-10-10 is, it's 80% of your diet is carbohydrates, 80% fat, and 10% fat to 10% protein. So it's dominated by carbohydrates. You almost don't have to think about the other stuff. You're basically just eating fruit and raw vegetables, and the 10% fat and protein, you know, you get those without thinking about it. So we went to that, I spoke at it, and not because I was into that kind of diet, but just I thought it would be fun to try, and it seemed like a really cool festival with camping and all kinds of different fun stuff. So we went to it, and we really did feel great eating that way. So when we came home, we decided to stick with it. Not for our kids at all. They weren't doing that. But we just kind of tried to do it, and we did it for about 3 or 4 weeks, and loved how I felt. I had really great energy levels. My problem was that I lost a lot of weight, and I just felt like, I don't know, like Mike Arnstein, the guy who put us on the festival, when he races 100-mile ultramarathons, he tries to be at 117 pounds, I've heard him say, which is extremely small, as you know. And he's not, I mean, he's a short guy. He's probably a little shorter than I am. He's going to be 5'5" or 5'6". But that's, you know, that's very, very small still, because he's kind of looks sort of like a stocky guy, usually. So that, you know, that being that light is a tremendous advantage if you can still be strong and healthy if you're running 100 miles. That every bit of weight is a big disadvantage, every extra pound. So, you know, I don't think it went wrong. I think it was fine that I was losing weight, but I just feel like since I'm not an ultramarathoner, as a pro, I'm not trying to win races. You know, I don't really want to be walking around at 120 pounds. So, I'm back to eating a more typical diet, but I definitely am having a lot more raw foods in my diet than I used to. Pretty much until, I don't know, probably almost dinner time, I'm eating mostly raw. You know, I may have something cooked for lunch sometimes, but not usually. And, you know, up 80-10-10 in general, I think I've talked to some people who I really do respect in their knowledge of nutrition. And I think, as you said, like, it sounds really good. It's a good story. And it's in the same way that paleo is an appealing story for a lot of people, and that's why it's been so successful and marketed so well, is that it's a really nice story. It's not nice to animals, of course, but paleo, speaking of it. But, you know, 80-10-10, those are very nice, well-packaged stories, and it's hard to say if that really means anything until you see actual data and what's happening when people do this for the long term. And, you know, people I've talked to said that that's probably not enough fat, because that, as a vegan in general, like, you've got to worry about omega-3s. You have to make sure you're getting what you need of them. And if you're restricting fats further than that, I think, you know, long term you're going to have some issues. A lot of people might, but I don't know. There's not that much data on fruitarian diet, so it's impossible to say. But I guess I'm a little bit wary of trying something that does have so little data. I'd rather stick with something that at least has some science behind it, saying that yes, this does work. And I think the plant-based diet is there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. It's and then it's just, you know, it's like I heard you mention on your podcast, you know, it's one thing to be restrictive, and, you know, you thought of at first about, you know, going out with friends and everything like that, but when you do the 80, when you're that restrictive, you're pretty much limited to eating before you go somewhere, and then, you know, maybe having a salad or something. But I think there's something to it. Like you said, it'll be interesting 15, 20 years from now to see how things fall out a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. I'm looking forward to learning more about it. And like I said, it has helped me eat more raw food, and just kind of reading that whole book gave me I started thinking about raw versus cooked food, something I hadn't really made much of a distinction in before. I just kind of ate what I, you know, plant-based diet, and try to eat a salad, try to eat a smoothie. But now I do, when I can, try to pick raw options or just more raw ingredients. I feel like it's something that we don't eat that much anymore. So I think, you know, I've taken that from it, and I probably eat a little bit less fat than I used to because of it. So I don't know. For me, that's kind of a good amount. That's a good balance of using some of the elements, not going all the way in. And I think I'm healthier for it. I think it's been a really good thing for me to try that out.
I have done just fruit after for recovery, and just, you know, kind of spent the afternoon after a, you know, 20-mile run or whatever, just, you know, eating fruit basically up until dinner. And I felt wonderful, and I felt wonderful, and I did recover. I was ready to do, you know, I'm trained for triathlon, and I was ready to do my bike ride the next day without any problems. So, you know, I do think that replacing calories and replacing sugar, it's good. Yeah.
Yeah, and when I mentioned on my blog that I was going to this and asked people if they had any advice, I got a lot of people who had been doing fruitarian diets, but then for one reason or another had stopped doing it. Maybe some, it just wasn't sustainable. But almost everyone who wrote to me said, my recovery on that kind of diet was amazing. Like, you'll be shocked at how quickly you recover. So I think that's probably one of the big objections. Is people, someone who eats a normal diet would hear about this and say, fruitarian, that's crazy. How would you ever rebuild muscle and recover from workouts? Because that seems to be the very thing that is one of the biggest advantages of eating that way. So I found that surprising. And that's when I am training more seriously, I think I'll probably swing further that direction than I am now towards the, you know, more food.
Yeah, I live down in Florida, and, you know, the heat and humidity, and boy, there's nothing better than, you know, eating a watermelon and, you know, the melons afterwards. It just made me feel so good.
I'm sure. Yeah, that sounds delicious.
So what's your running future look like here in the next, what's next?
I think right now that what's next for me is to try to get fast again. Like I said, after I qualified for Boston and had worked on that for 7 years, it was really nice to get into ultra running, because if you haven't done any ultra running, and I don't know if you have, but the feel, it's much, much more laid back and relaxed. And you walk up hills, you take 5 or 10 minutes in an aid station, you change your shoes if you need to, you grab a bite to eat. Very, very different. And the training is different too. Like, there's probably a place for speed work in training for ultramarathons, but it's kind of argued about. People don't know for sure if speed work really does help you. So a lot of the mileage is much slower and longer, but slower. So I've kind of been in that mode now for 5 years, and I feel like I'm finally ready to get back to fast shape, and it's like, get, you know, improve my, I think it would improve my fitness level to train hard for a marathon again. To get into 3 hours would be really nice. I was, when I qualified for Boston with a 3:10, I felt like that was within my grasp, and now it doesn't feel like that anymore. So I'm at least 2 marathons away from doing that. You know, who knows even if I can do that. But that's kind of what I'm excited about right now. I would still love to run a few more hundreds, because I really want to run the Badwater Ultramarathon one day, which is the 135 through Death Valley, and it gets really hot. But to me, that has just always been like the most epic of ultramarathons, and the one that I feel like I would do, and then my career would be done. I would say I did everything I wanted to do. I ran Badwater. But you've got to run 300 miles just to get into that. Three separate 100-mile runs, I should clarify. So that's a long ways off, but long-term, I'd still like to do that one day.
That sounds great. I've also noted that your podcasts are maybe swinging a little towards motivational and looking into some motivating factors. Is a motivation book in your future?
I don't know. That's quite possible. I don't think that will be my next book. Next book will probably be like a Nomad Athlete kind of cookbook. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I love that stuff. And I write about it now and then, but not too much, because it kind of has nothing to do with Nomad Athlete per se. But yeah, like motivational stuff, personal development, self improvement, whatever you want to call it. That's I'm really into that stuff, and I've been like a Tony Robbins fan forever. I buy Zig Ziglar tapes and Jim Rohn things, just all kinds of that. That's what I listen to on runs for the most part, and those are very often the books I read. Certainly, those are more modern authors too. Seth Godin is a guy I'm a big fan of, and some others. But yeah, I feel like I. In some ways, I feel much more expert in that topic, really, than I do in diet and fitness, because, like, you know, I'm really just a regular runner who has worked pretty hard and gotten, you know, done some pretty good things for my own genetics. But I'm not a world-class runner or anything like that. And I didn't know anything about a vegetarian diet until I gave it a try 5 years ago. So I'm still learning about that. But you know, self-improvement or personal development, that stuff, I feel like I've done it my entire life, read that stuff. So I do have a good understanding of that. So I think one day I'll put out something. It might just be a short ebook or something. But, yeah, one of these days.
All right. Well, I'll give you the first question that you need to answer then. As a cardiologist, people come to me already sick and have been sedentary a lot of the times for a long period of time. And, you know, I've had this discussion with other people I've interviewed so far is, you know, the difference between me and, say, a nutritionist or, say, a spa-type setting where people go to regain their fitness is those people go, when they go see those people, they've made the commitment that they want to change. But when people come and see me, they come sick and they really want to be fixed, but they really haven't thought anything much about changing themselves at this point, because oftentimes they haven't really seen that maybe they were involved in the process that got them sick. So how do you, so my dilemma has always been, so all of a sudden, you know, I'm plant-based and I'm trying to teach my patients to become plant-based, and I throw plant-based, you know, you throw all this stuff at them and, you know, not to keep them running and screaming out of here thinking that I'm a total nutcase. So how do you motivate those people, do you think, to, you know?
That's a great question. I think if it's just to motivate them to make a change, I think they need to be very, very clearly shown, like, the path you are going down is leading you towards this future, and this is not a positive thing. So I feel like the more kind of sensory and just I don't know the right word, but the more intense the feelings they can be, and, you know, actually seeing pictures or reading stories or just like being really involved and seeing this is someone who was just like you and here's what happened to them because they didn't make a change. I feel like people need to associate their current lifestyle with immediate pain, even though that pain isn't going to happen until some years in the future. And I think that's the big problem, is people think of the future as being entirely, we don't think of the future as being like it's truly going to happen for some reason. It's very hard for us to put ourselves in, you know, fast forward 10 years and say, here's where I'll be. So I think that would certainly increase motivation, but I don't know. If someone doesn't want to change, it's very hard to change them. I know that for sure. And as for the plant-based diet specifically, there are two schools of thought. There's the go all in, try everything at once, just make a massive sudden change. And because the change is so massive and so sudden, you'll start to notice the results very quickly. And within 2 or 3 weeks of that, you'll start to feel better and you'll notice that, you know, you're not breathing as heavily when you walk up the stairs. You have a little more energy. You feel better. And the idea then is that positive feedback early on like that will be enough to keep you going. I think it's worth trying, and I'm someone who likes to go for it and like really get excited about a change and just try to make it all at once. But I feel like every plan that prescribes that approach should have two phases. The first one is do this, and then when and if it fails on, you know, day 10 when you decide, I'm tired of this, I'm going to go have a cheeseburger, you don't look at it as, okay, I guess I failed, and I guess now that perfection is lost, I give up, and then you just eat 10 cheeseburgers the next day because you're done. I feel like then you shift to plan B, and plan B is the small steps approach. It's okay, now I'm going to reset, and now I'm going to start taking things away one at a time. So first get rid of the beef, you know, 2 or 3 weeks later, assuming the patient's not ready to die and doesn't need the sudden and drastic change, and they have a year or two to transition to a diet, transition to a smaller steps approach. So I think taking small steps really is a huge key for lasting change, and a lot of people just ignore it as a possibility. They try to go all in, then they fail, and then they give up. And I think there's another option that's change, you know, trying more gradually after that first attempt has failed. So that's kind of a long answer, and I haven't honestly thought about this too much from your perspective, but that's what I would do.
Yeah, well, that sounds like this certainly a good idea, and I'll certainly be referring certainly my younger patients to your website for the 5K and nutrition steps, guides and things.
Great. So, all right.
So that sounds fantastic. All right. Well, I, certainly wish you all the best of luck in your running future, and I'll continue to be a podcast listener, and I'm going to try to get more in line with your Boston qualifying plan so that I can actually tick that BQ box eventually. It's been something that's eluding me a little bit, so...
Well, it eluded me for a long time. So good luck. Stick with it.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for chatting with me.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Bye.
I hope you enjoyed listening to the interview with Matt. He provided some interesting nutritional information as well as some pearls for training for marathons. His podcast is also very good, The No Meat Athlete, so you should check it out. I also have enjoyed his books, and I think the cookbook that he has will probably be good as well. You know, I think over the last couple of interviews with Celia and with Gordon and now Matt, we've kind of proven that you can do well running endurance events. Do well running endurance events, even up to 100 miles on a plant-based diet. I think one thing that they have in common is that their GI tracts, they tolerate the distances better. I think dairy is a huge problem when people do endurance events as far as stomach cramping. You know, a lot of my patients will come up and say, you know, or I've heard people say, as you know, I'm sure many of you have, that they just didn't have enough energy on a plant-based diet, and that's why they stopped it. But, you know, I think we've proven that that's not the case. I think in that, if somebody's feeling that way, they need to look at actually what they're eating, and they may not be getting either enough calories or nutrient density. Sometimes people kind of lean towards bread and pastas and cookies and cakes and not very healthy plant-based diets, especially if they're more ethical. So I think you need to look at, you know, adding more fruits, vegetables, you know, again, low on oil, increasing the whole grains, you know, rice, quinoa, as opposed to the flour type or grains that are made into flours. I think what he said as far as, you know, not giving up if you, you know, try to do a plant-based diet and it doesn't work for you, you know, you can always try again, start the next morning, reassess your situation, just make a point to add, you know, more fruits and vegetables, make sure you're getting enough of the quantity. When you're eating whole foods in their natural state, they're not calorically dense, so you do need to eat more. When you're eating flour things, however, or things with oil in them, they're very calorie dense. So if people aren't losing weight and they're trying to go plant-based, that's usually where it is. It's either hidden oils in the processed food or a lot of grains made into flours. You know, you don't have to achieve perfection the first day. Most people's stories start with they tried to go plant-based and maybe fell off the wagon or were persuaded elsewhere and then just, you know, tune back in. I think a lot of people eventually that do go plant-based start out with some of the faux meats and some of the more processed foods and then hone into more of a whole plants, whole fruit-based diet. I think once you do that, your taste buds really change and you start to crave the nutrient-dense food and not so much the junk foods. So it's just a matter of kind of weaning yourself off of all the oils and processed food and then onto a more whole fruit and whole vegetable diet. I talked earlier that we're coming upon eating season. I would encourage you to consider signing up for an early spring or late winter event. To help you train, even if it's a 5K or with a goal of a half marathon or a marathon late in the spring. It's always helps to have something to train for. You know, I think Matt made a good point that to get better, you need to have consistent training over time. I know when I first started doing the marathons, you know, I train for one and take a break, then train for one and take a break. And I think, you know, it's a lot easier to keep that level of fitness going, especially through the holidays and eating season. So I encourage you all to keep your training up through the holiday season. So check out Matt's website, No Meat Athlete. And if you have any questions for me, I can be reached at jamiedulaney@gmail.com. That's jamiedulaney@gmail.com. I wish everyone a healthy and happy holiday season, beginning with a healthy plant-based Thanksgiving.